Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 242. The Red Book of C.G. Jung with Nancy Ferlotti. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
He stepped aside from seeing psychology as being based on psychopathology and neurosis and wanted to go deeper and discover a deeper influence here. And out of his own experience with the unconscious, he recognized that there is something called the individuation process, which is a process that guides all of us towards greater wholeness. And for him, it's a symbol-making process, and that, of course, is reflected in a lot of the mythologies and the comparative religions that he studied, and he experienced that personally himself in the Red Book.
That was the voice of my guest, Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti, speaking about Jung's Red Book. Nancy Ferlotti, M.A., is a Jungian analyst in private practice in West Los Angeles, and is past president of the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles. As a member of the faculty, she teaches, lectures, and supervises candidates and interns. Nancy did her analytical training at the Los Angeles Institute while also participating in the Research and Training Center for Depth Psychology, according to C.G. Jung and Marie-Louise von Franz in Switzerland. She's also an active member of the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts. Outside these groups, Nancy teaches and lectures in the U.S. and Switzerland and has a number of publications, including The Archetypal Drama in Puccini's Madame Butterfly, Angels and Idols, which is a chapter in the upcoming book Psyche and City, A Soul's Guide to the Modern Metropolis, her article Tracing a Red Thread, Synchronicity and Jung's Red Book, will be published in Psychological Perspectives this fall. Nancy has a deep interest in exploring the manifestations of the psyche through dreams and myths, with a specific focus on the dark emanations from the psyche. A current focus of research is on the Quiche Maya creation myth, the Popol Vuh. Her interest in exploring symbols and deepening her understanding of Jung have landed her on two foundations: the Archive for Research in Archetypal Symbolism, and the Philemon Foundations, where she's recently assumed the position of co-president of the board of directors. She's an enthusiastic supporter of their publications, which she believes are important contributions not only to the Jungian community, but to the world. Nancy was instrumental in helping to get C.G. Jung's Red Book published and in organizing the Red Book exhibit and dialogues at the Hammer UCLA Museum in Los Angeles. Now, here's the interview. Nancy Ferlotti, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have you. We've been playing phone tag, cat and mouse, whatever you want to call it, because you've been so busy with the Red Book.
Yes, I have. I'm, as I'm sure you know, the co-president of the Philemon Foundation. And our foundation supports the publication, the preparation and publication of all of C.G. Jung's unpublished writings. And, of course, the most recent publication is the Red Book. And we are just absolutely thrilled to finally have it out of the bank vault.
Yes. Well, it's been a thrilling event, I must say, as somebody out there in that audience. And you know, I heard about your work with the Philemon Foundation through Monica Wickman, another Jungian analyst who I gather is a friend of yours.
Yes, she is.
And she recommended that you'd be the best person to talk to about Jung's Red Book.
Oh, Well, I don't know if I'm the best, but I'm one.
Yeah.
I certainly have been involved in the process, at least for the last few years. It's really Dr. Sonu Shamdasani, the general editor of the Philemon Foundation and also the editor of the Red Book, who is the one who has been working on, has worked on this for 13 years. He's the expert, I would say.
Yes, and I did try sending him an email. He's probably very busy. I never did hear back from him. Maybe I didn't have the right email address. But at any rate, I'm very happy to have you on the show. And before we get more into the Red Book, let's start out with you having us tell a bit about your background. When did you first become interested in Jung?
Oh, goodness. Okay. I became interested in Jung when I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And I have always been seeking something that answered questions for me, or that brought a deep understanding of the reality of the world and the reality of the spiritual world, kind of the intersection between the unconscious world and the conscious world. I grew up in a family where my father was psychotic. He had manic depression.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up killing himself when he was 40 years old, and I was actually 7. And for my first 7 years of life, I lived in a world where the unconscious was very much alive and very much present for me. And so the veil between the conscious realm and the unconscious realm was really permeable. And my psyche was deeply affected by that. And for me, no organized religion made sense. I was not able to be contained within that framework. I was actually raised a Mormon. So I started reading, I started trying to find answers for my own experiences, which I had growing up. And during that period, late in my 20s, early 30s, I came upon Jung, and the light went on for me. It just felt like it was such a significant way of understanding my personal experience. And at that point, it was Memories, Dreams, Reflection.
Yes.
The first book that I read, and then Man and His Symbols. And I realized that this was an answer for me. And so I decided to go back to graduate school and get a degree in clinical psychology with the intention of becoming a Jungian analyst, because I knew that going through training would really deepen the process for me. It would intensify my own work in analysis and my own individuation process. And that really was what I was called to do. And I'm so struck by this Red Book in being able to see Jung's own journey into the unconscious, into his inner world. And he talks about it as an experience. It's so important to experience the journey. And that's what I felt I did growing up. I was in it and experienced it, but I didn't understand it at all. And it was actually quite overwhelming for me. So I have to say that my own Jungian analysis was really a lifesaver for me. And I'm very happy to be able to work with my own patients and help them bring some clarity out of darkness.
Now, where did you go for your training as a Jungian analyst? And I understand it can be very hard to get in sometimes.
It is. It can be very hard to get in. What they're looking for is really your own relationship to the psyche. They want to see that you have the capacity and the flexibility to really be able to do the work and to tolerate being pulled by the opposites. Anyway, I did my training at the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles, and at the same time, after I had been in that program, I guess about 2 years, I met a man, Teo Apt, who was the head of the very institute that Monica attended over in Switzerland, the Research and Training Center for Depth Psychology, according to C.G. Jung and Marie-Louise von Franz. And so I decided to supplement my training by participating in that program. And I didn't officially go through that program. I was one of two auditors that were permitted to come and take the courses and participate as fully as I wanted to participate. But I did end up getting certified in Los Angeles.
Well, that's great. Now, the Red Book was published earlier this year with great fanfare, and not just in the Jungian community.
Yes, that's what's so surprising about it,
yeah.
To tell you the truth. It's a book that has found its time. It's like a good wine that is finally ready to be drunk. It's just amazing to see the number of people out there who are interested in this. And I was in charge of organizing the Jung exhibit here in Los Angeles at the Hammer UCLA Museum, of course, with all those wonderful people over there at the Hammer Museum, Annie Philbin being the director. It was a gorgeous museum, and it was exhibited for 8 weeks. And during that period of time, there were Hammer dialogues, which consisted of an analyst and then somebody else, an artist, a writer, a journalist. We had Jack Kornfield, the Buddhist, and a number of other people. And frequently, the analyst who was participating in the dialogue would ask the audience who was a Jungian and who wasn't. And the majority of people were not, and they really did not know much about Jung. But they were curious, and they were absolutely fascinated. And those dialogues sold out completely every single night. There were about 350 seats in the auditorium, and then the Hammer would allow in up to 1,500 people. And most of the time, there were over 700 people who attended these dialogues. I mean, it's really remarkable to see that. We never, ever expected it. What's so interesting is that this book was published by W.W. Norton. The publisher, Jim Mars, originally wanted to print, I think it was 1,500 copies of the book. Norton was really scared, thinking, this thing is never going to sell. We're never going to make our money back. So they cut back the initial printing to 5,000. And now it's up to 45,000. They're on their sixth printing with 10,000 copies sold in the German edition. I mean, it's just beyond what anybody anticipated.
Well, I imagine some of that popular interest was generated by the write-up in the New York Times where it was reviewed. I think that must have helped it to become a more widespread cultural phenomenon.
Well, I think that's true. And Sarah Corbett was the one who wrote that article in the New York Times Magazine.
Right.
She's really quite a delightful woman. And she was with us for the week when we were over in Zurich at the scanning of the Red Book in November of 2008. And I had a chance to get to know her. And she was there the entire week watching the whole process and taking notes and getting to know all of us there, and was really enthusiastic about writing this article. She had to talk the New York Times into doing it. I think that they weren't so sure that this was going to be a good idea. She was able to prevail. And she wrote a fun article there. Most people really enjoyed it tremendously, of course. There's always a group that doesn't think it was scholarly enough or whatever, but what it did do was to reach out to the world. It reached out to a whole group of the population who really did not know anything about Jung.
Right, right. My wife and I were surprised to see the book referred to in one of the last episodes of the TV series Law and Order.
Oh, my goodness.
Did you see that? Yeah, and we were shocked and disappointed that it was portrayed in the context of an evil, satanic cult. Did you see it as well?
No, I wasn't able to see it. I saw the just a little snippet on the internet, but I didn't see that whole episode.
Well, unfortunately, it was not good PR for Jung or the Red Book.
That is really the problem. Trying trying to maintain a certain level of dignity and respect around this book. And, of course, there are a lot of people who really don't understand the significance of it. And so they are going to want to use it in different ways like that, because it's such a cultural phenomenon that they enjoy riding the crest. But what's not good is that it's a very, very serious book. I don't know, have you read it? Have you dipped into it?
I have. I'm a little embarrassed. My wife got it for me for my birthday, and so far I've looked at the pictures, which of course are amazing. I have not actually dug into reading it yet. Doing these interviews, I am needing to read so many books that it's been hard to get to it, because I'm interviewing a lot of authors, and so I generally have about a book a week to try to digest. So,
oh well, you couldn't read this one in a week, I'll tell you.
Yes, I know.
It's going to take us all a lifetime to try to understand. And when you read it, you can only take it a small chunk at a time, because it's so intense.
Yes.
And I think most people really enjoy the paintings. But the amount of suffering that you experience when reading this, you're right down there with Jung. It's very difficult. It's a difficult experience. So I think that, anyways, I feel that people need to really, really give it the respect it deserves. And I'm hoping people will get something from it, and I'm sure they will on varying different levels.
Yes, definitely. Now, I imagine that there are some folks listening who've never heard of the Red Book, despite the spate of recent publicity, and we've been talking as if people know what we're talking about. So let me, back you up just a little bit and say, what is the Red Book, and why is it so important?
Okay, all right. That's an important question to answer. The Red Book is Jung's personal journey into the unconscious. It came out of his interest in the psychology of religions and the process of how the psyche goes about creating religions and a connection to what he referred to as the God image. It also is a reflection of the individuation process, which was a term that he coined. And physically, it is a book, a calligraphic folio manuscript that consists of 205 pages altogether in the published version. There are 53 paintings that he did and included, and they were done in a gouache paint. And there are 71 text images, along with, of course, 1,500 footnotes. The original book contained about 416 pages, and it was a red, large, very large format, leather-bound book that he ordered for himself. I think he ordered it from a Zurich bookseller, but it looks very much like a beautiful Florentine book. The book itself feels like a medieval manuscript, because it's written in this beautiful calligraphy, illustrated just so elegantly and with such care and perfection that you can really feel the intensity and the care that went into it.
And in fact, the care that you and the folks working on this project went into it to reproduce it as faithfully as possible, so that people who have a copy, as I do, really have purchased a work of art. If nothing else, it is just in and of itself, as an object, it's really a work of art.
It is. It really is. It's absolutely a gorgeous book for those people who haven't seen it. The paintings are, in my mind, just not to be believed. They are so beautifully done and so interesting. They really grab you, because they contain an intensity that is right out of the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
The book itself, well, Philemon insisted on making sure that this was a full facsimile version of the original. And we approached different publishers about publishing this book, and some of them felt that it would be too expensive. They wanted to do a smaller version with, let's say, 4 images to a page, or different permutations that didn't actually reflect the entire book. And we just all said, no, it has to be a full facsimile version. And that's what we have, and I think that was absolutely the right decision, because it honors the incredible work that Jung put into his own book. Now, the biggest complaint that I hear about this book is that it's so big and heavy and cumbersome, it's hard to sit down and put it on your lap and read it.
That's true. I had to, you know, just to find a place to keep it in the house was a challenge.
It doesn't really fit
on a regular bookcase. I had to, you know, instead of standing it upright, I laid it on top of other books in the bookcase. That was the only way I could fit it in.
Yes, I know. And a lot of people are buying book stands for this.
Yes. Yes.
So everybody has to figure out the most comfortable way to sit and read it. But I'm always reminded of what my 95-year-old aunt, who was a pediatrician her entire life, said to me not too long ago. She said, "Strong women live longer." I love that. I like to tell people when they complain about the size and weight of the Red Book, well, lift it and carry it and know that you're getting stronger and you'll live longer because you're carrying this weight around.
Yes. Now, it's written kind of as a journal. And I understand there were one or more books called the Black Book or the Black Books. Can you say what the relationship is of the Red Book to the Black Book?
The Black Books were Jung's journals, and he had 6 of them. The first one actually is Brown. It's the Brown Book, and that's one he had in adolescence. And then he continued writing in those, and he would finish one, and then after he finished the Brown one, then he went, and it just so happened that they were black. And he would write down his dreams in those books. And then in between November 1913 and April 1914, he wrote the Black Books 2 to 5. And in those books, he included his dreams, but he also began having a whole series of visions. And he documented those visions in those books and began the process called active imagination as a way of beginning to interact with the visions and to begin to understand the meaning of those visions and the images in the visions, to try to understand who these characters were that were appearing in his visions. And the first series of visions he had to do with devastation across Europe. He was actually on a train traveling to his wife's parents' city in Switzerland, and he had a waking kind of apocalyptic vision of Europe completely devastated and covered with blood. And he had this vision twice, and it just came in upon him. And the second time it did, a voice said, "And this will become real." And of course, at that point, he did not know what was going on. He thought that maybe he was falling into a psychosis. He was very concerned about that. And he had about 8 of these visions during this period of time. This was also the period of time when he wanted to return. He was drawn. Psyche had drawn him back into delving more into his own material. He felt that there was a split in his personality that needed to be healed. And he'd been the doctor for quite a long time. He'd developed his relationship with Freud. He was very successful. He was a brilliant psychiatrist and scientist. but something was missing, and he felt that his soul was missing, and he needed to introvert and delve into the unconscious to try to recover this other part of his personality. Now, to take a step a little bit further back, Jung worked as a psychiatrist in a psychiatric hospital in Zurich, and he worked with psychotic patients, a lot of schizophrenic patients. They were called dementia praecox at that time. That's what schizophrenia was called. And he began to see that the fantasies that these patients had were sometimes connected to mythologies or folklore that these people didn't have any connection to. And that led him to the idea that there must be a substrata in the psyche that is not personal, that contains collective material. And out of that experience, he began to develop the idea of the collective unconscious, which is a concept that people talk about fairly frequently these days. And when he decided that he needed to go back in to do his own inner work and to try to recover his own soul, part of this process had to do with really wanting to understand what that level was all about, to explore that for himself, and to see the relationship between that and the conscious realm. And so his own psyche was pulling him down into his own confrontation with the unconscious, which is described beautifully in a chapter in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. If anybody's interested in reading that, that's very helpful, kind of as an introduction to the Red Book. So during this period, this is also shortly after he split with Freud. He broke with Freud in about 1912, and that same year he published Symbols of Transformation, or the first version of Symbols of Transformation, which Jung could not accept, and it was...
You mean which Freud could not accept?
Freud could not accept. Yeah. And it was all about an exploration of mythology and this collective unconscious realm seen through the kind of the case material of one woman who ended up becoming schizophrenic. And it was her fantasy material that he explored. And Jung, before this, kind of leading up to the publishing of this particular book, he had taken it upon himself to study mythology and study comparative religions and fairy tales. And so he really was delving into a lot of this collective material, along with Gnosticism, and Eastern religions, all of that. And so he had this fund of knowledge when he descended into his own psyche, and a lot of that appears in the Red Book. You have references to Gnosticism and all sorts of different mythologies. I think it's important to see that he really had a deep understanding. He was really trying to put pieces together and trying to understand them.
So the material that he had been intellectually steeping himself in consciously was also finding its way into this unconscious journey.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So he stepped aside from seeing psychology as being based on psychopathology and neurosis and wanted to go deeper and discover kind of a deeper influence here. And out of his own experience with the unconscious, he recognized that there is something called the individuation process, which is a process that guides all of us towards greater wholeness. And for him, it's a symbol-making process. And that, of course, is reflected in a lot of the mythologies and the comparative religions that he studied. And he experienced that personally himself in the Red Book.
Now, Jung has been depicted as, by some biographers as something of a madman during this period. Does the Red Book shed new light on that issue? Does it, you know, put the lie to that issue?
Yes, it does. It absolutely does. Jung also, at that point, when he started having those visions of destruction across Europe, he thought he was falling into a psychosis. He thought he was going mad until war broke out. World War I broke out. And then he realized that these were not his personal dreams. These were collective visions that he was having, apocalyptic, prognostic visions of what was coming. And at that point, he was, of course, devastated that this horrible war was upon him. But, of course, personally, he was relieved that it showed that he wasn't going mad, that it was really the collective unconscious speaking to him. And people think that he was mad during this period because going into the unconscious like this is really quite a mad thing to do. But he wasn't mad. He held on to his consciousness the entire time. He had a wife. He had five children. He had this family to take care of. He was continuing to see his patients every single day. He had a vibrant practice. He had, throughout the whole process of his descent into the unconscious, there's evidence in material through communications and journal keeping that he had his group of people around him with whom he talked about the Red Book. A lot of his own patients and colleagues were encouraged to do the same thing that he was doing. In other words, to drop down into more of a subliminal consciousness to encourage these visions. Other people were doing the same thing, and they were comparing notes. They were trying, all at that time, in a very collaborative way, trying to understand what was going on here. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the name Tony Wolf.
Yes.
His mistress, or as he said at one point, or maybe it was von Franz who said that she was actually his second wife. She was in collaboration with him at this time, and she actually typed out his first drafts of his, I think, out of the black books or some. Anyway, she was the first one to actually type the material out for him. And she was involved in this, and she was attempting to do this herself, and a lot of other people were also. So he wasn't alone in some dark room all by himself, descending into the unconscious. He had support. He had support from her. He had support from his family, other colleagues, and his whole group in Zurich. And so he never lost consciousness. In other words, he never fell into the unconscious, which is the definition for a psychosis.
Yes. Do we know if Jung ever intended for the Red Book to be published?
Yes, we do. He talked about this being published with his colleagues. He prepared it for publication. The Red Book itself consists of layers and layers of work. So he was constantly editing the material. He would have it typed out, and then he would go over it. He'd talk about it with his friends, and then he would edit it, and he would go back and revise it. And even after he finished the Red Book itself, I believe it was in about 1920, he went back and edited the typeset, which was the material he used to include in the actual Red Book. So there was this continuing process of going over this material, over and over this material, trying to understand it. He worked on it from 1913 to 1930, so it was a very long time. And it was his way of trying to understand this, the raw material that came to him through his experiences, and come to some sort of a formulation and understanding of what it meant, and to put it in the language that could be understood scientifically and psychologically. So after doing this, he spent the rest of his life trying to make it understandable in a more scientific way.
Does the Red Book in any way add to or deepen Jungian theory?
Oh, absolutely. It adds to and deepens Jungian theory. Sonu Shamdasani likes to say that without the Red Book, you really don't have a whole picture of Jungian psychology or what Jung was all about. And if you didn't have anything else and you just had the Red Book, you would have everything that was significant to Jung about his psychological theory.
Hmm.
And the thing that becomes so interesting in reading the Red Book, so interesting for me, and I know interesting also for James Hillman. I have had this conversation with him. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Yes.
The archetypal psychologist.
Right.
What becomes apparent in the Red Book is the importance of the experience of the inner figures and the experiencing the image, rather than pulling away and trying to label it and trying to interpret it. And that's what Jung does. The Red Book is not a psychological book. It's an experiential book. And in the Red Book, when you read it, you will see that Jung is very present with those inner figures. Philemon, for example, and Salome. He is right there with him, and these figures are very real. These are not fantasies. These are real figures. And that's a difficult point to get across, that the psyche is as real as what we call reality or matter. There is no different. One is a reflection of the other. And in this book, that message comes across absolutely clearly, that he's not interpreting. He's not reducing these images to some label. He is having a very real dialogue with these inner figures, just like you and I are having a dialogue. These figures to him are as real as you are to me right now. And I think that's extremely significant. And in the collected works, he talks about this element throughout, but you don't actually get the experience of that. It just becomes, that reality for him becomes so much more evident and so much more real when reading the Red Book. And for me, that is the most important factor.
Yeah, let me ask you a kind of a related question. Does the Red Book have any implications for the practice of Jungian analysis?
Well, yes, it does. Absolutely, it does. It takes us back to the core of who Jung was. And Jung was not a Freudian. Jung was not a follower of Freud's. And his theory was so different from Freud's that was really the reason for the split of those two schools. And it becomes very clear. I think what it does is that it demonstrates to Jungians that we have a different foundation. We are not, our foundation is not based on psychoanalysis. Our foundation is based on something that was developing before psychoanalysis, and it is substantially different. And it comes through genuine experience. It's a whole different way of working, and I think it's an important reminder for us. And yes, it potentially can have a huge impact on analysis. Now, I'm sure a lot of analysts are pretty set in their ways, and I don't know to what extent they will be affected by it. If you really read it and study it and experience it, you can't help not being affected by it, though. You really can't.
Now, I see that you've written an article on the Red Book and synchronicity, and like most of us, I'm fascinated by synchronicity. What illumination did the Red Book provide you about that elusive phenomenon of synchronicity?
Well, it was more than just the Red Book. In the article, I talk about my involvement with Philemon and how from the moment I received a phone call from Steve Martin, who was one of the founders of the Philemon Foundation, I was drawn in because of synchronicity. There was one synchronous event after another that I followed in my involvement with Philemon leading up to the publication of the Red Book, and it continues. For me, to tell you the truth, it feels like Jung is the guiding force behind this foundation and what we're all doing.
Mm-hmm.
And just to give you a couple of examples of this, I became a board member of the Philemon Foundation, and it just so happens that I had a friend whose husband had a Book of Dreams published, and I was having lunch with her, and we were just talking about some of the interesting things we were doing, and she and I mentioned that we were trying to find a publisher for the Red Book, and she talked about how fabulous her husband's publisher had been, and that was Jim Mars at Norton. And so we contacted him, and it just turned out that he was thrilled with the idea of this project, and it went forward so easily. And another friend of mine was interested in the Red Book, and in a conversation just mentioned that he had a friend who was a writer for the New York Times, and that turned out to be Sarah Corbett. And just it's as if ever since I got that call from Steve, little things like that, important things like that, have just been falling into place all along the way. And so I think about this whole process as one long series of synchronicities. And of course, synchronicities are activated. We recognize these synchronicities when there's an activation of archetypes out of the collective unconscious. And of course, when the archetypes get activated, then all sorts of things happen. There are all these breakthroughs into reality out of the psychic realm. And these are just two examples I gave you of synchronous events that I experienced, but other people on the foundation board experience the same thing. And with a book this powerful and with all this material that's yet to be published in the Jung archive, it's so deeply important to all of us that it's no wonder that the archetypes get activated, the collective unconscious gets activated, and we all experience these synchronistic events.
Well, that's really fascinating. I know I've gone through one or two periods in my life of sort of synchronistic runs, and I've always thought, well, I must have been on the path. Must have really been on the path at those particular points.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, part of the importance of a synchronous experience is to recognize it. And I think that we have these experiences all the time. It's like a thread from the psyche that wants us to follow it.
Yes.
And it's important to pay attention and to be conscious of what's going on. And then we will see them. You know, a lot of times things happen and we just dismiss them as, oh, well, that's kind of a coincidence. But maybe not. Maybe there's something more important there.
Right. You know, one thing that I wanted to ask you, it seemed like Jung could so easily enter into that reality. And for me, I don't seem to be able to access that. I think that, you know, many people probably would have difficulty accessing that altered state of consciousness, if you will, where you would get that level of reality. And the closest I've come to it, I think, is when I'm falling asleep, sometimes I will hear a voice or a phrase that's kind of very, very startling and doesn't really feel like me. You know, where the heck did those three words come from, you know?
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's absolutely it. But, you know, I think Jung had a real facility for this, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
He was very open to it as a young child, and I think it was easy for him. But he also talked to some of his colleagues about how to actually do it, and he would basically say you want to sit quietly in your room and try to silence your mind and get yourself kind of into a state of meditation and allow a voice to enter in. And then when that voice enters in, then you begin a dialogue with it. That's actually the act of imagination. That's how you begin the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then for him, because he was so visual and it was so easy for him, he could actually drop right into the fantasy. And there were times, he said, when it became too terrifying for him and too much, that he would have to stop it, and he would go and he would do some yoga for a while to calm himself down, and then he would come back to it. So I think he was a very special person with an ability to do that. Now, the fantasies that came to him when he wasn't attempting to induce them were another thing, and I think he was also open to those, because there are suggestions that when he was a boy, he had this kind of fantasy imagination. And his mother was very psychic and very open to a lot of this, too, and that he described his second personality as being very similar to hers in that intuitive and open sense.
Having taught for many years, and I've taught a course called Myth, Dream, and Symbol for a lot of years, and I certainly have seen a number of students that seem to have more of that sort of facility, you know, where they have very archetypal dreams and very easily enter into, you know, the worlds of fantasy.
Yeah. And I, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I think that that's what happened to me. And that's why I found Jung was such a perfect fit for me, because I too am able to go into the fantasy realm very easily. And I certainly, with my early experience of kind of living in and out of that unconscious realm in the environment of my father, who was obviously in and out the whole time, I find it very easy to drop back into that.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of opened me up very early on, and to a similar extent, it may have opened Jung up very early on to the ability to drop into the fantasy world.
Yes.
I did read a study done by, an anthropologist that was interested in how certain people are able to drop into fantasy, kind of related to the shamans, and I should go back and get that study, but evidently a certain percentage of the population has this facility to do it and have waking fantasies and waking dreams.
Right, and we live in a culture that doesn't particularly reinforce that.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. That's so true. But I think the way that the Red Book has been received in the world shows that people are interested, that there are probably a lot more of them out there than we know. And they seem to be really coming out of the woodwork here with this interest.
Well, time is getting on here. As we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
Oh, well, let me see. I guess the other thing that I'd like to say, being the president of the Philemon Foundation, I'm always kind of wanting to let people know about the Philemon Foundation. We do support all of Jung's unpublished writings, and we've got about 30 more volumes to publish, believe it or not. And
wow.
We have published two volumes already, the Jung White Letters, which deals with the issue of evil, and Children's Dreams, Volume 1. And we've got the second volume of Children's Dream Seminar coming out soon. And then the Jung Schmied Letters are coming out soon, and that deals with Jung's concept of typology, which is going to be very interesting, and all sorts of other projects that are in the pipeline.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I would love to talk to you again down the line, if you'd be open to it, about the problem of evil and about children's dreams. Those are both fascinating topics, and Maybe you could bring some of that information out to us.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I love the issue of evil.
A strange thing to say, but I understand.
Isn't it? It is a strange thing to say, but it's so important that we understand evil both in ourselves and in the collective.
Yes, yes.
That really is a foundational piece in Jung's work, and falls into our shadow, which is another one of his terms. He's got all these wonderful terms, but...
Well, we will leave that as a teaser for a future interview. And Nancy Ferlotti, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
I hope you were stimulated by this dialogue with Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti. Wow, what a distinguished career she's had in the Jungian community. I'm struck that her terminal academic degree is an MA, and yet she not only got into the LA Jung Institute to become an analyst, but eventually became president of that institute and also co-president of the Philemon Foundation, which has brought the Red Book to us. Way to go, Nancy. I'm sure many of you would be interested to hear what Nancy has to say about Jung's writings on the problem of evil and also on children's dreams, so hopefully we'll be able to get her back for that. As you heard me say, the Red Book can be appreciated as an art object. Jung's paintings have been faithfully reproduced, and the illuminated calligraphy is reminiscent of the Book of Kells or some other monastic production out of the Middle Ages. I do hope I eventually get around to reading it. Maybe that'll happen when I retire from my current state of retirement.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and it plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hello, everyone. The interview that you just heard with Nancy Ferlotti was one of those in which I was hearing a slight echo of my own voice some of the time we were speaking. I've mentioned this echo issue before, and I'm still doggedly trying to figure out how to eliminate it. You didn't hear it because I'm able to go through the recording and erase it. But as I've suggested before, that's a time-consuming extra step that I'd just as soon eliminate. The tech support folks at Skype suggested I try an older version of Skype. That didn't fix it, unfortunately. And they made one other suggestion, which I won't know until another interview or two whether or not it's going to work. I bring all this up really just to share with you that Nancy Ferlotti has been extremely helpful in making herself available for several calls after this interview to see if we could debug the problem. Given her very full schedule, I'm both grateful and impressed that she has made herself available to me to help out with this. So if you hear this, Nancy, let me say thanks again. Once again, let me remind you that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook fan page. This is in addition to our Yahoo discussion group. Some people like Yahoo discussion groups and others prefer to chat on Facebook. So if you're already on Facebook, you can find our fan page by simply typing Shrink Wrap Radio into the search area at the top of the page. Or if you go to shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll see a new Facebook icon in the right-hand sidebar, and clicking on that will get you on our fan page. And there's also an icon there for the Yahoo discussion group, which you're welcome to join as well. And since making this announcement, I see at least one new post on our fan page, and that's great. Be sure to catch my latest Wise Counsel podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com. My interview there with singer-songwriter Meg Hutchinson on music and living with bipolar disorder. Meg is an accomplished artist, a folk singer, actually, with 6 solo albums under her belt. You'll also find a written transcript right on the page with the audio interview. Meg experienced her first substantial depression at age 19 and then later began to experience manic swings. She's learned to balance her ambition and desire to take on many commitments with the practical demands of maintaining her emotional health. Now, the most recent transcript added to the Shrink Wrap Radio website is number 239 with Buddhist teacher James Barris. I want to thank volunteer transcriber Jamie Johnson for her excellent work on this inspiring interview. In fact, most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free. So thanks to all the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides an incredible value. However, I'm always looking for new transcribers to help us keep up. So please contact me if you'd be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. And of course, please visit our Shrink Wrap Radio store where you'll find t-shirts with the Shrink Wrap Radio logo. I need to get a new one myself. As well as archival CDs and links to my 2 online continuing education credit courses. One is on Wisdom of the Dream and the other on Positive Psychology. And reminding you that Shrink Wrap Radio is largely a labor of love. I do put a lot of time into each episode. It's a lot more time consuming than maybe apparent, for example, taking that darned echo out. So your donations do help to keep my motivation alive in this 6th year of the podcast. And thanks for responding to my plea, those 4 of you who sent in fresh donations since the last show, and several continuing donors as well. Your contributions are greatly appreciated. So if you're somebody who's been sitting on the impulse to make a donation, hey, go ahead and get impulsive. Just look for the big green donate button on the Shrink Wrap Radio site.
It's Jeff and Carl Jung saying, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Your thoughts on the show, Carl?
I think there will be a reaction. A great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Right on then. Take it away, Dr. Dave.
Oh, what fun. I could use more listener contributions like that. Just hinting. Now, here are a few recent emails from the old email bag. First, we hear from Pete, who responded to my thanks for his donation with the following. David, I am only so happy to make a contribution to your excellent show. I'm an ongoing subscriber and have written you before. I've been listening since spring of 2009. Those were very dark days for me. As I saw my retirement nest egg severely erode, and my part-time IT consulting work disappear. I spent last summer painting my house, quotes, working in therapy, both of which were immensely enriched by your 2 podcasts. I'm now working again, sadly forced out of the retirement lifestyle I loved, but am grateful for the inflow of income. This one-time payment is reflective of my new situation. Now that I can, I want to pay something towards my debt of gratitude to you for supporting me and inspiring me the past year and a half. I love your recent Jungian focus and very much looking forward to your Red Book show. I would love to hear shows involving a more somatic therapeutic view, like perhaps the Hakomi Method, the work of Ron Kurtz. Besides IT, I'm also a gyrotonic teacher. my former little retirement business I had to give up recently, and am very interested in the latter end of the mind-body continuum, which I feel gets short shrift. I really wish you well, and please keep the shows coming. Hugs, and that's from Pete. Pete, I'm so happy to hear about this positive reversal of fortune in your life. I definitely know what you're talking about in terms of shrinking nest eggs, but I'm glad that Shrink Wrap Radio has been a source of encouragement to you during these tough times. And I'll take your suggestion to hear about some more somatically oriented shows. At the same time, I think there are some previous shows that you may have missed that are definitely somatic in their orientation. For example, number 96, Body Mind Healing Psychotherapy with Michael Mayer, and number 41, Body Mind Healing with Qigong, which is also with Michael Mayer, number 74, Behavioral Medicine, Chinese Medicine, and Monastic Psychology with Brother Bernard, actually it's Bernard Seif, and number 162, Tea and Empathy, Combining Acupuncture, Hypnosis, and NLP with Seattle acupuncturist, martial artist, and NLP practitioner, and now friend, Randy Clare. Those are all pre-2009, so you might have missed them, but they are available in the archives at shrinkwrapradio.com. Peter Todd, my Australian guest from a couple of episodes ago, dropped a line of 4th of July greetings, writing, "Dear David, many thanks in the spirit of the geopolitical holism of which I spoke during the interview. Happy Independence Day. Keep up your enlightening podcasts on Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm sure that they are a source of inspiration for many. Kind regards, Peter B. Todd." Peter, thanks for that encouragement, and I loved having you on as a guest. Finally, here is one from the Shrink Wrap Radio fan site from John, who wrote there, "Hi, Dave, great podcast. I'm a mental health nurse in England working in early intervention in psychosis service. It would be great if you would get Marius Rom on your show or someone from the European Hearing Voices Network. Rufus May would be another great guest. He's a clinical psychologist who received a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia when he was in his late teens. He's since become a well-respected, if somewhat controversial, figure in the UK, championing a more open-minded view of schizophrenia. Would be great to hear a few podcasts on these themes, both on here and on Wise Counsel. A podcast on a Jungian view of psychosis would be cool, too. Great work, Dave. Keep it up. I listen to your show usually when I'm driving around at work, in between visits, and in the community, and it certainly helps me to stay open-minded and positive about the work I do here in the UK. Many thanks, John." John, thanks for those suggestions. If you can get me email addresses of any of those folks that you mentioned, that would help me to issue an invite to them. It's exciting to hear about your work. One of my sons actually is in training to be a nurse right now. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As usual, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the website. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. Somebody leave me a voice message on the phone. I don't think I've had one in the last year. The number is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti for sharing her experience and insights on C.G. Jung's Red Book. My next show will be with Dr. Dan Ariely, a behavioral economist, TED.com presenter, distinguished Duke University professor, and author of the new book, The Upside of Irrationality. Be sure to tune in to something irrational and different next time. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.